You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Novel idea. A book startup wants sexy reading to be guilt-free. No dragons, either, by Casey Wickman. With illustration by Diego Malo, which shows a couple on a picnic blanket with food and books strewn around them. Erica Cirullo and Claire Mazur have made a career of being cool spotters and curators, first with their beloved bygone retail shop, One of a Kind, or rather of a kind, then their A Thing or Two newsletter and companion podcast. Their latest venture is 831 Stories, which Cirullo describes as an entertainment company with books at the foundation. Think of film distributor A24, with a sensibility that extends beyond movies and into co-branded scented candles and posters, but for romance novels. A nod to late 90s pager code for I Love You, with its 8 letters, 3 words, and 1 meeting, 831 Stories will publish 6 books by different authors in its first year. First, Big Fan by Alexandra Romanoff, in which a politico forms a connection with her childhood boy band crush, and then A.C. Robinson's Hardly Strangers. Beyond the page, 831 will offer clever merchandise like hats embroidered with classic romantic tropes, enemies to lovers, in-person events for readers, and bonuses such as a recording of an original song from Big Fan. In the romantic fiction space occupied by such juggernauts as Harlequin and the rising tide of romance titles from major imprints, Cirullo and Mazur identified a fan base of 30 million plus readers with a bottomless appetite for characters who confront real-world thorns, but are still guaranteed their happily ever after. However, there was a perception problem. These books, when we were growing up in the 90s, were sold at the grocery store and had a very specific bare-chested aesthetic and were always presented by the broader culture as books for people who did not read books, Cirullo says. The challenge, stripping the label of guilty pleasure from the joyful experience of reading romance and making it just pleasure. But sex is still core, Cirullo insists, estimating an average spice level of 3.5 chili peppers out of 5. Today, the duo want to be ambassadors for romance as a force for good. You pick up a romance novel, and you know that there's going to be a piece of joy in it for you and a comfort level in it, Mazur says. I always know I'm going to feel safe within the constraints of this book. At least for now, stories in the planned interconnected 831 universe will be set in contemporary times, and plots will feature women whose professional success does not depend on the status of their relationships. The rest of her life cannot hinge on this relationship, Cirullo says. We really like the idea of self-actualized female main characters. It's just nice to see that in the world. The following article went to press some months ago and seems worthy of rereading. Fault lines. With tensions still running high over the war in Gaza, many of the Upper East Side's Jewish denizens are circling the wagons, by Hannah Seligson. With opening illustration of a cityscape by Tim Buckley. Not too long ago, a non-Jewish lifelong New Yorker who grew up on the Upper East Side was asked by a friend to host a screening of the documentary film Israelism. She immediately said no. It wasn't that she necessarily disagreed with the message of the film, which bills itself as the story of young American Jews battling the old guard to redefine Judaism's relationship with Israel, revealing a deepening generational divide over modern Jewish identity. Rather, this would-be screening host feared being socially exiled by many of her Jewish friends and possible career consequences. "I want to be brave," she told me. "I'm disappointed in myself." As the summer season kicked into gear and much of the Upper East Side migrated to Long Island's East End, no one wanted to get canceled. Not right when guest lists are drawn up for some of the most exclusive parties in the Hamptons, often held at the sprawling estates of some of the wealthiest people, including some of the wealthiest Jewish people on the planet. In the wake of October 7th, much of Manhattan's moneyed Jewish elite has doubled down on what is considered acceptable behavior and speech related to Jews, anti-Semitism, Israel, and the war in Gaza. There is enormous pressure not to step out of line for reasons that are historically understandable but less defensible, considering the right-wing takeover of Israel and the questionable motives of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to continue the war in order to avoid possible jail time. Netanyahu has pleaded not guilty to charges of fraud, bribery, and breach of trust. As the war stretches on, with the international community calling for a ceasefire and protest having roiled campuses across the country, this set has become an island upon an island. Numerous outspoken voices, along with some quieter ones from the hushed corners of St. Ambrose, the one on Madison Avenue, are leveling accusations of anti-Semitism, liberally using the bad Jew trope for those who aren't in lockstep with what they believe it means to be pro-Israel. To address the elephant in the room, it is almost impossible to talk about wealthy, powerful Jews without conjuring abhorrent tropes and stereotypes that will lead people to accuse you, me, of being anti-Semitic. But just like many non-Jewish cultures in America, there is an elite segment, and that is who I am examining. This is a third-rail issue, but it should not force everyone into silence, particularly when the stakes are so high. Before we go much further, I'm part of this world, one where people pay $43,000 a year for nursery school. I'm also a Jew who attended 12 years of Jewish day school, spent 7 seasons at Jewish summer camp, and attended an Orthodox synagogue. I lived in Israel for 3 months after high school, part of the time on a kibbutz. I can, on a good day, speak, read, and write in Hebrew. I can say October 7th was horrific. I can also say the bloodshed and starvation since then has also been horrific. In April, at a rally for the hostages at Dag Hammarskjöld Plaza near the United Nations, Congressman Jerry Nadler, the current longest-serving Jewish member of the House of Representatives, was booed after calling for life-saving humanitarian aid for the Palestinian people, while also acknowledging heinous crimes committed by Hamas. Park Avenue plastic surgeon and Upper East Side resident Ira Savetsky heckled him, saying, "How does it feel not to be welcome among the Jewish people?" Nadler responded, "I think I am welcome," to which Savetsky rebutted, "They're pissed at you." Savetsky presumably included. Recently, Savetsky's wife, Lizzie, a fashion influencer, commented on the Gaza Health Ministry's death toll data in an Instagram story, telling more than 350,000 followers that Israel has killed 14,000 Hamas operatives. You get 7,200 Palestinian civilian deaths. That would be a pretty good ratio as far as wars are concerned. Reached for comment, Ira pointed to what he called widespread dissatisfaction with Nadler among various constituents and accused the congressman of continuing to prioritize seeking approval from the most extreme members of his party. Lizzie also sent a detailed response, declaring that she, along with every Jew I know, want peace. It is quite shocking that media and others would blindly accept numbers and information that originate from a known terrorist entity. My video made the point that even with the numbers they've provided, which have been reduced by the Gaza Health Ministry, she wrote, adding links from the AP and Newsweek that she said supported her comments, it is still the lowest known ratio of combatants to civilians in modern ground warfare. Some academics question how various sources define combatant, with some data including all men ages 18 to 59. There's a phrase making its way around social media's Jewish glitterati, the types of people whose names adorn wings of museums. A kefiah on an American college campus is just a hipster swastika. Another one circulating in this crowd is the tagline of the Instagram account at Let Our People Go Now. No ceasefire, no compromise, let our people go. Some Jews of this ilk, I've been told, view a ceasefire as a capitulation to Hamas that will put it back in power. If you want to ruin a playdate among the socialites of Park Avenue, I caution you not to mention that more than 2% of the children in Gaza have been injured or killed. Go to any cocktail party on the Upper East Side, and there is no open and honest conversation about what is happening in Gaza, says Amanda Urey, CEO and founder of Manhattan Private School Advisors. Urey says Upper East Side Jewish families account for 40% of her client base, typically a total of about 450 in any given year. Her clients pay her more than $20,000 to land their offspring at New York City's top schools, where tuition can run another $65,000. Yes, status still reigns on the Upper East Side. The neighborhood might be leaning a bit more tribal. See, the new Upper East Side Jewish Day School, Emmett Classical Academy, which was flooded with applications when it announced its opening a few weeks after October 7th. But none of Yuri's clients, she says, turned down top-tier schools. Even if parents didn't love what they call the both-sidesism of the various administrative responses to October 7th, says Urey, they aren't saying no to Dalton, Spence, Brearley, Fieldston, Horace Mann, Riverdale, Trinity, even Dwight. If you feel a need to take a stance on the Israel-Gaza war, perhaps another area of New York would be a better place to live, says Urey. If you want to make a stance on anything, the Upper East Side is probably not an ideal place to do it. Cue Upper West Side resident Jerry Seinfeld, whose comedic brand used to be going on about nothing. But post-October 7th has been increasingly vocal about his support for Israel. There is a social contract here on the Upper East Side not to initiate a controversial conversation, because you never know whether the person you are offending is someone you'll need to get your kid into school or raise money from for your hedge fund. It's like England in the 1950s, Urey says. Yes, the winds blow differently on the Upper East Side, a cloistered, moneyed enclave, home to many Master of the Universe types, who to some degree create the weather. It's a kind of influence and power that allows them to live in their own echo chambers and steer clear of people who challenge or disagree with them, or just completely obliterate those who do. See Ackman, Bill. A former development professional at a mainstream Jewish organization tells me that she's seen how fear, based in a core of reality and magnified on purpose and not on purpose for well over a decade, has diminished some of the Jewish community's ability to think beyond themselves, or generously, or realistically. Some American Jews are understandably traumatized by what happened on October 7th, when Hamas killed nearly 1,200 people in Israel and took an estimated 240 hostage. In early June, the Israeli army confirmed the deaths of 4 of the 80 hostages believed to still be alive. A military operation weeks later resulted in the rescue of 4 more, though the Gaza Health Ministry said the Israeli army killed more than 270 Palestinians in this mission. According to the NYPD Hate Crime Task Force, there were 81 reported anti-Semitic incidents between January and April last year, compared with a reported 46 targeting the Muslim community. On a national scale, the Anti-Defamation League reported a 140% surge in anti-Semitic incidents in 2023, compared with 2022. In June, the editors of Wikipedia concluded that the ADL is no longer generally reliable as a source on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and can only roughly be taken as reliable on the topic of anti-Semitism when Israel and Zionism are not concerned, in part because it is a pro-Israel organization and often categorizes criticism of Israel as anti-Semitism. The Council on American-Islamic Relations reported a 178% increase in anti-Muslim incidents for the last 3 months of 2023. Both organizations said these numbers had set records. The moment feels existential for worldwide Jewry, and for many on the Upper East Side, the impulse has been to turn inward. When I ask Mijal Bitton, spiritual leader of the Downtown Minyan and visiting researcher at NYU Wagner Graduate School of Public Service, for her opinion on Upper East Side Jews closing ranks, she tells me that it's a complicated observation and that she wouldn't describe it that way. The complexity, says Bitton, who recently returned from a tour speaking about Israel and anti-Semitism at several U.S. graduate school programs, centers on how betrayed many Jews feel by their supposed allies. She describes a dynamic that cuts the other way just as easily. I'm hearing from my Upper East Side Jewish philanthropist friends that in the art community, even calling yourself a Zionist and speaking of support of Israel makes you persona non grata. I have another friend who is a lifelong supporter of feminist causes, but feels she can't talk about the sexual violence taking place against Israeli and Jewish women at the hands of Hamas. When I tell a Palestinian friend of mine who used to live on the Upper East Side that expressing horror over the death toll in Gaza felt out of bounds in certain wealthy Jewish enclaves, for instance, at my son's $43,000 a year predominantly Jewish Upper East Side preschool, or at any restaurant on Madison between 96th and 60th Streets, she agrees, worrying I'd get the attack line of being a self-hating Jew. My friend, who has strong ties to both Israeli and Palestinian communities and was recently in Israel, laments, "It's so sad that Jewish friends of mine are afraid to open their mouths and say they sympathize with people who don't have their homes, people who have been sitting in a tent with no food, no water, no clean bathrooms for months and have been moved 5 times. In some ways, wealthy Upper East Side Jews are starting to sound like hardened Israelis. New York Times opinion writer Megan K. Stack reported on Yehuda Schlesinger, a right-wing Israeli journalist who said that the people of Gaza deserve death, a hard death, an agonizing death, and instead we see them enjoying themselves on the beach. Stack argued that Schlesinger isn't a fringe figure and asserted that Israelis wouldn't be shocked by his bloody fantasies. Some stores in Israel sell bumper stickers that say "finish them," referring to Palestinians. But the mood among the moneyed and powerful class of Jews might be shifting. On May 22nd, Endeavor CEO Ari Emanuel blasted Netanyahu as the problem creator and a failure, characterizations that were booed by some in the audience. He emphasized it was now up to Israel to decide how this war ends, which he framed as a necessity for the security of Israel and the sake of innocent people on both sides. That means negotiating a political two-state solution that delivers peace, security, and dignity for all. But even seemingly sensible points of view, ones that acknowledge the harsh realities and sufferings of both Israelis and Palestinians, aren't taking hold among the well-heeled on the Upper East Side, a neighborhood where it feels like the radios are all turned to the same frequency and produce the same loop of talking points. Namely, Jews are the only real victims, most Palestinians are sympathetic to Hamas, and there are many other wars taking place, such as in Ukraine and Sudan, and no one is protesting those. Ergo, the world's outrage to the war in Gaza is a double standard and undeniable anti-Semitism. In March, when Senator Chuck Schumer said that Netanyahu has been too willing to tolerate the civilian toll in Gaza, a friend of mine who lives at an enviable Fifth Avenue address and has been on the front lines of fighting global anti-Semitism, investing loads of time and money, and who is no radical leftist, texted me, "You're crazy New Yorkers," referring to the dynamics I'm writing about, "are missing the zeitgeist." Context, as many learned in the aftermath of October 7th, is off limits. That still holds true on the Upper East Side. In other words, you can't say there is any basis for October 7th, even if exploring the backdrop can help explain why and how the events occurred. A resident of the Upper East Side, who runs in a high-achieving social circle of executives, lawyers, and media types, tells me what happened to her at a posh dinner party when she tried to make a point that when history is written, Hamas might look heroic to some because they put the Palestinians' rights back on the table. At a time when the Israelis were ignoring them and focusing on making peace with the Saudis and Emiratis. It ended, she says, in allegations that I support Hamas. During the early phase of the war, she would post on social media about the devastation taking place in Gaza, but stopped because, she says, I was going to lose all those friendships I'd had for 30 years. My Jewish friends were saying to me that I was adding fuel to the fire of anti-Semitism by exposing how many people are dead in Gaza. She says the social fallout is ongoing. Three of her Jewish friends, she says, aren't speaking to her and avoid sitting next to her at group dinners. In January a year ago, I went to a soiree in a palatial loft downtown for PEN America, which recently had to cancel its literary awards because nearly half the honorees withdrew over the organization's perceived sympathy with Israel. Salman Rushdie was there. The conversation naturally turned to the intersection of Israel, freedom of speech, and social shunning. One guest told me that Matthew Lindenbaum, one of the executive producers of Israelism, which recently landed a U.S. distributor and is available to stream on Apple TV+, Prime Video, and Google Play, had really become persona non grata. Lindenbaum signed a letter to support a New York State bill called Not on Our Dime, Ending New York Funding of Israeli Settler Violence Act, and contributed to a 2022 research report on philanthropy and the Palestinian Freedom Movement. Lindenbaum declined to comment for this piece. For someone whose family's name adorns the middle school gymnasium at Ramaz, the modern Orthodox Jewish day school on the Upper East Side, these positions amount to heresy. Anyone who is a super outspoken critic of Israel in tight-knit Jewish circles faces a social cost, says Simone Zimmerman, who speaks in Israelism about how she was taught by the Jewish schools and summer camps she attended to support Israel at all cost. The Upper East Side is not unlike other insular pro-Israel communities, and that is one of the reasons why we don't see more people speaking out, because of the high cost to your own personal life. The Upper East Side's social shunning has also led to some strange alliances, ones that seemed unfathomable before October 7th. A year ago, Jill Kargman, an astute chronicler of this wealthy bubble and a denizen of the Upper East Side, wrote the blog post, "The enemy of my enemy may not be my friend." Kargman, who is a well-known Donald Trump critic, disclosed that she accidentally reposted a right-wing maniac simply because they were pro-Israel and liked social media posts by women who firmly believe abortion is murder and are anti-choice and pro-locking up doctors. Kargman, pointing to unlikely agreement with Republican Congresswoman Elise Stefanik, concluded that while this is a time of strange bedfellows, she was getting out of their bed. The bedfellows are indeed getting weird. Recently, the ADL, which strongly condemned the Trump administration's immigration policies, honored former Upper East Side resident and senior Trump administration advisor Jared Kushner. As for Trump, he recently said that Jews who vote for Democrats hate Israel and their religion. In her blog, Kargman warned, "Both fringes are BFTJ, bad for the Jews. So instead of sticking with Stefanik, let's just stick together." Another Country, Searching for James Baldwin in the South of France by Jimmy Briggs. Opening photo, James Baldwin at his cottage in Saint-Paul-de-Vence, France, 1979. Since James Baldwin's death nearly 40 years ago, the Literary Lion's final home in the South of France has drawn a procession of acolytes to the Provençal community of Saint-Paul-de-Vence, where he spent the last 17 years of his life. The 300-year-old villa in which he resided no longer exists. By 2019, developers had converted the site into a luxury apartment complex. But that hasn't deterred generations of admirers, inflamed and enlightened by Baldwin's prose, from making a pilgrimage, including me. Seizing the occasion of the writer's centennial year, I paid a visit in April. My first stop was a table at a Baldwin hangout, the Café de la Place on Place du Général de Gaulle, for a croque monsieur and a double espresso. My entry point into Baldwin had been his first, arguably greatest work of fiction, Go Tell It on the Mountain. I devoured his oeuvre as a student and journalist and author. He became my muse and my specter. At times, I wasn't sure if I was looking over his shoulder or he over mine. Like countless other black writers confronting Baldwin, I grappled with what literary critic Harold Bloom termed the anxiety of influence. The artist's internal burden of trying to overcome the relentless tug of a predecessor's literary gravity. As Toni Morrison put it in her eulogy at Baldwin's funeral in 1987 at Manhattan's Cathedral of St. John the Divine, "You gave me a language to dwell in, a gift so perfect it seems my own invention. I have been thinking your spoken and written thoughts for so long. I believed they were mine. I have been seeing the world through your eyes for so long. I believed that clear, clear view was my own." When he moved to Vence in 1970, Jimmy B., as his friends called him, was ill from what was thought by some to be hepatitis, physically and emotionally exhausted by his pace of creative output and downcast from a sputtering civil rights movement. In parallel, yours truly, Jimmy B., spelled J-I-M-M-I-E-B, as opposed to J-I-M-M-Y-B, arrived in Vence, rageful over America's backsliding from a so-called racial reckoning in 2020, demoralized by the protracted war in the Middle East, exhausted by the mask I'm often compelled to wear, and feeling somewhat ill from the lingering consequences of high blood pressure and kidney transplantation. Since the emergence of Black Lives Matter and a raft of films and critical text burnishing Baldwin's legacy, he's figuratively everywhere. Yet in Vence, I was to discover, he felt nowhere. It wasn't so much a matter of choosing France. It was a matter of getting out of America, he told the Paris Review in 1984. My luck was running out. I was going to go to jail. I was going to kill somebody or be killed. Baldwin, I came to realize as I roamed the back streets, had made his home here, not just to flee, but to be enveloped in a place of permanence, of protection. Saint-Paul-de-Vence has been settled for 1,000 years. Its oldest quarters lie behind 50-foot stone walls. He could not be harmed here. He had also come to retreat amid a beauty he couldn't access as easily at home. The valley below in the town he knew was dotted with glitzy villas, swimming pools, and Mediterranean views. Marc Chagall lived here and is buried in the local cemetery. Amid the cocoon of the village and the magic of the landscape, Baldwin could simply be without anyone looking down on him or singling him out. He was often seen in the company of actor Simone Signoret and Yves Montand at Café de la Place, watching people play La Boule. Initially reticent, The residents took to the charming raconteur from Harlem, who delighted in engaging in conversation with anyone, regardless of social status. His rented two-story cottage of stucco and stone stood behind high iron gates. On the property was an outhouse, a gatehouse, and the home where Baldwin lived and wrote, mostly in solitude. The orchard on the grounds could sustain lemons, figs, grapes, pineapples, and pears. In the backyard was his so-called welcome table, where he would receive Nina Simone and William Styron, Stevie Wonder and Miles Davis, Josephine Baker and Maya Angelou. The house itself was filled with art, including works by Beaufort Delany, the belatedly appreciated Black American painter whom Baldwin cared for in his later years. On the mantel was the French Legion of Honor he was awarded in 1986. Yet on my wanderings, I came to learn that the village has no official acknowledgement of Baldwin's homestead, nor of the man himself. Visitors in search of some Baldwin shadow, of that tug of gravity, must navigate narrow cobblestone streets lined with galleries, boutiques, card shops, and open-air cafes. Excusez-moi, madame, pouvez-vous me dire comment trouver l'endroit où vivait James Baldwin? I haltingly asked the solemn-looking woman in l'office de tourisme. Je vois Baldwin Museum sur Google Maps. Are you American? She replied, smiling. I didn't know if I should feel relieved or offended. She brushed back her gray-streaked locks and leaned over the counter, suddenly congenial and curious. Oh, yes, she beamed. Go tell it on the mountain. I have read this book many times. In a flurry of only slightly accented English, she told me she had lived for decades in Chicago. When I asked what she missed most about her life in the States, she said, I like the American way of getting things done, and the meat. Was there a Baldwin Museum? I inquired, showing her directions on my iPhone app. His house is long gone, she replied. There's nothing there now. I made my way toward the door, and she looked up to wave. Good luck finding what you're looking for, she said, and turned back to help another flustered visitor. Indeed, after a futile search, I found no plaques bearing Baldwin's name. France, of course, fiercely preserves the memory of its native sons and daughters. It has also kept space to memorialize the Doors' Jim Morrison, and adopted artists from Oscar Wilde to Gertrude Stein to Richard Wright. They are all buried in country. Baldwin's presence here, however, exists only in books, or in the stories the locals tell about him, or in the spirit of those who come to find it. The American exile who had embraced the République Française had become, in the end, the outcast once more, a figure quietly revered, yet, with the passing years, more feared and forgotten. The week of my arrival, there had been articles in the French press about the country's percolating resistance to Aya Nakamura, a French singer of Malian descent, who was under consideration to sing an Edith Piaf anthem to open the Summer Olympics. Despite being the most popular French-language singer in the world at the time, her authenticity as a representative of France was a matter of fierce debate, especially on the far right. According to French President Emmanuel Macron, she may yet open or close the ceremony. Back home, commentators were ruminating on O.J. Simpson's death earlier that week, and how his 1995 acquittal on murder charges had divided American society. It was a week in which Baldwin would have had a lot to say. Or maybe the point was that those of us who followed in his footsteps should say what needs to be said or explored in our own voices through our own lenses. Letting that sink in, I came to understand, as I sat in yet another café, that I had found what I was looking for in Saint-Paul-de-Vence, an older, wiser Jimmy B. Now here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Ryan McAmis. Patti LuPone, the theater legend and star of both Broadway's The Roommate and Marvel's Agatha All Along, on Vitriolic Critics and Real Estate Regrets. What is your idea of perfect happiness? A calm and peaceful mind, landing a joke, being the name right after, and the winner is? What is your greatest fear? Falling, on stage, or anywhere? Which living person do you most admire? Rachel Maddow. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? My Sicilian impulsiveness. What is the trait you most deplore in others? The trait that ignites my Sicilian impulsiveness. What is your favorite journey? Southeast Asia, the Irrawaddy River on a refitted Rhine cruiser. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Blind allegiance to a demigod. On what occasion do you lie? Backstage, after a show. What do you dislike most about your appearance? My nose, which John Simon described as my lupine visage, a clever play on my last name. Of all the theater critics, he was the most vitriolic. Which living person do you most despise? Really? Is it not obvious? Which words or phrases do you most overuse? Doll, and do you know what I mean? What is your greatest regret? Not buying that apartment in that brand new building opposite Lincoln Center in the mid-80s for that inside price. What or who is the greatest love of your life? My husband and my son and the life we've been blessed with. When and where were you happiest? Filming Penny Dreadful for 5 months in the Republic of Ireland, sublime land of berries and spontaneous song. Which talent would you most like to have? I would love to be an instinctual chef. I wish I could open the kitchen cabinets and create a masterpiece. How would you like to die? Not as a victim of another mass shooting in America. What is your current state of mind? Extremely troubled, with no end in sight. What is your most treasured possession? Mementos from Broadway opening nights. The Evita death mask made into a hand mirror, and a real eggshell with a lighted scene from Anything Goes inside. What do you consider your greatest achievement? My son, Joshua Johnston. Where would you like to live? On the Mediterranean Sea, with a view of the setting sun. What is your favorite occupation? My current and only one, the one that chose me at 4 years old, and that I'm still lucky enough to continue to do. What is your most marked characteristic? See above, re Sicilian. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? Oh, too late for that. What do you most value in your friends? Laughter first and foremost, acceptance and love. Who are your favorite writers? Orhan Pamuk, Hilary Mantel, Thomas Hardy, Edith Wharton. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? Neely O'Hara from Valley of the Dolls. Who are your heroes in real life? Firefighters and first responders. What is it that you most dislike? Unearned standing ovations. What is your motto? If I don't see you after the show, you were fabulous. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Patti LuPone. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.